Good evening, everyone. And I find it quite precious to sit together in a kind of a concentrated silence of a room full of 40, 50 people, and to have 30 minutes of such silence. It's kind of the silence in some way becomes richer the more people who share in it. That's my sense. I don't know how it is for you. But anyway, it's pretty rare for us to have, I think for any of us to have the experience of being in a room full of so many people and to have a kind of a healthy silence between us that we share, sitting here quietly. So one of the purposes of mindfulness practice and one of the purposes of Buddhist practice is so that we can be at peace with ourselves, and be at peace with the world around us. And in order to find that kind of peace, it helps a lot if we frame our life, frame the problems of our life in a framework which is helpful, conducive towards creating peace. Now what happens is a lot of people many of us are framing our experience constantly without knowing that we're doing so, that we're experiencing our life experiences, our relationship to other people, our work, or whatever it is, through a certain framework of interpretation. And it could happen even coming to a meditation practice or a spiritual practice. We have a framework for it. So, for example, the framework might be, what's in it for me? Maybe the framework is we have certain kind of desires, we want something. We want all kinds of things at work, at home, in relationships. And so the framework is, how does this tie into my desires? Or the framework might be one of fear. Some people have pervasive fear in their lives. And so everything is seen through that filter of their fear or their resistance. And the fear or resistance might be invisible to them, but everything is captured through that framework. One framework is the idea of my true self, my true self-expression, who I really am. I have to find out who I really am. And everything relates to some idea of the quest of somehow connecting to my true self. A framework can be how it relates to my security or my status at work, for example. What's my status? How does this relate to my status? How does these things that are happening to, how does it relate to some values or some framework or some something that we think is useful? Something we want from life. The Buddha was very aware that we frame our experience in our interpretations of it. And the Buddha suggested not that we do away entirely with frameworks in our quest to find peace, but rather, he said, a lot of the frameworks that we use for understanding ourselves, understanding our problems in life, are not necessarily so conducive to becoming peaceful. So, for example, if your framework is what's in it for me, you might get a certain satisfaction and a certain sense of well-being when things prop you up and support you as an individual, as a self, the kind of self-concept you have, whatever. But as long as you are operating under the notion of a self-concept that we're holding on to and framing our experience, that itself is not going to allow, that is going to hold us back from being most at peace. There's a wonderful term coined by a Tibetan teacher some years ago called spiritual materialism. And more recently I've heard people talk about spiritual narcissism. And that there's a very fine line between spiritual narcissism and spiritual maturation or spiritual freedom. And in our culture, in our kind of so-called New Age culture or whatever, there's a lot of people who don't see the difference between pursuing a spiritual path for narcissistic reasons versus reasons to become free. Narcissistic reasons are, again, what's in it for me? I'm going to become the most, radiant spiritual person in my block, and I hope everyone notices. There's all these ideas about what it means to be kind of a good person or successful person, or adequate person, so... if we go to the latest workshop and retreats and kind of have, military medals, done all these retreats. And And the line is not so clear because the ego, our egotism is often very invisible. And sometimes we will engage in spiritual life in the service of our egotism, as opposed to service to liberate ourselves from the need to be egoistic, to be self-centered or attached in some way. So the Buddha suggested a framework that he thought was very helpful and useful and conducive to finding peace, inner peace and outer peace. And that was a framework of what's known as the Four Noble Truths. And this is something that many of you know. It's something that many people can learn in 2 minutes. You can learn what the formula is for the Four Noble Truths. It's said in Buddhism that it's considered very difficult to understand the profundity of the Four Noble Truths. And it's said only someone who's fully liberated, fully awakened, really understands how the Four Noble Truths apply to our lives. So the Four Noble Truths are stated very simply. There is suffering in human life, that we have the experience of suffering. The second truth is that there's a cause for suffering, and that cause of suffering is, the Buddha defined, as thirst. There's a cause of our suffering, and it's thirst. So that needs to be explained, of course. The third noble truth is that there's a possibility of ending our suffering, bringing it to an end. And the fourth noble truth is that there's a path that helps us bring it to an end. Some people have some trouble with these ideas, especially because the Buddha used the word truth. It sounds like something you have to believe. And it's explicitly not meant to be something to be believed in, but rather to be a framework, like a tool, to help you understand your life. Like, this is a really useful tool, the Buddha said, is this tool of the Four Noble Truths. And in talking about it this way, he said he had kind of a... rather than saying you have to believe in these four, he said they describe actions you need to take. And the actions, the first one is, there's something you need to know. You need to know about suffering, about your suffering. The second is you need to understand the cause of that suffering. The third action is to realize the possibility of ending the causes of suffering and finding peace. And the fourth is the action is that of engaging yourself in the Eightfold Path and these various helpful steps that you can make. The Buddha being, 2,500 years ago, he had only 8 steps. Nowadays, there's more, but 12, for example. But the Buddha had the 8-step, model, and we're kind of like, the 8-step club here. So why is this a helpful framework? One is that suffering is not something you can argue about whether it exists or doesn't exist. Suffering, when you suffer, you know it. You have a very direct experiential experience of suffering. There are a few Buddhists who occasionally will argue that suffering doesn't exist. But, you wonder what they're talking about when you're, miserable. The suffering is something we experience quite directly. A lot of other ways in which we want to frame our experience, they're almost like metaphysical ideas. It's very hard to actually find them. And so if you can't actually find them, it's hard to work with them. One of the most common frameworks that people use is myself. And as soon as you have myself, you have all these associated ideas about who I am. I'm a woman or a man. I'm a certain age, I had a certain life experience, I have a certain ethnicity, and I have a certain kind of profession, and in my culture, in this culture, to be a man means I'm supposed to be this way, to be a woman means I'm supposed to be this way, or whatever. We have all these associated ideas of what it means to be a self, to have a self, to support a self. We look for our essential self, we look for our true self. And it's really common in our culture to use the word self as a framework for understanding our experience. But if you start looking for what is the self, you'll have a hard time. Because the self is not something. The self is, if anything, it's like a flowing process, which is never standing still. And you can't, as soon as you try to point to it, it's already flowing along. It's like if you take a bucket of water and take a bucket and fill it up with water from a river, and then walk around and say, here's the river, people are going to laugh at you, right? The river is still, you know, you left it there. As soon as you left, the water you took out is not the river anymore, but the water that's in the river is the river. So the same thing, if you try to look for a self and identify something, this is who I am, you have a hard time. And you end up actually with a lot of metaphysical confusion. If you've studied any kind of philosophy, you realize that it's one of the great perennial quests of philosophers is to define the self, and none of them agree. You know, it's been a quagmire for thousands and thousands of years. So the Buddha said, don't try to frame things according to the idea of a self, but rather frame things according to something that you can directly experience, and that is you just suffer. You can know that you're suffering. You might be confused about who you are. Once you start with something you directly experience, then we can start asking ourselves, what is it, the conditions and causes for that direct experience? If you frame something on a metaphysical principle, it's really hard to find the causes behind it. So the first noble truth is that there is suffering. Part of what this is a call in Buddhism is for us to be attentive and respectful for our suffering. I think many of us know that there's a strong tendency in human beings to avoid their suffering, to numb out, to deny it, to turn away, to distract ourselves from it, to find, have all kinds of funny relationships to it. Sometimes we suffer and we assign blame. You know, you're the cause of my suffering. Sometimes we blame ourselves in unhealthy ways, unreasonable ways. But the call is to really feel it and see it directly in an uncomplicated way, just to feel and acknowledge the suffering. A lot of people, when they first encounter Buddhism, will find that it's a real relief to discover a religious tradition which seems to very honestly acknowledge the suffering that exists in the human condition. That they've been in traditions, for example, where it's been denied. I remember once, I did a memorial service for a young woman who died, and her mother was a Buddhist, and her father was a fundamentalist Christian. And so we were going to have this Buddhist Christian memorial service for this young woman who died. And I had never done a memorial service. It's my first one I'd ever done. So, and I hadn't been to many, so I didn't really know what's supposed to happen exactly. I mean, I'd been to some, but. And so I had something in mind that I was going to do as part of the ceremony. But I thought, well, I'll just take the cues from the Christian minister who's going to come. You know, just, you know, I'm sure he has lots of experience, and I'll just kind of, you know, watch what he does and kind of harmonize and kind of, you know, go through this dance and harmonize and do this wonderful but painful ceremony. And so he went first, and he got up and he said, death shouldn't exist. And I thought it was an odd statement to make at a memorial service. And I thought, I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. So I think, oh, he's speaking to our human situation. You know, when we're filled with grief and sorrow over someone's death, you know, we want to deny its existence. It's like, we shouldn't exist. That shouldn't happen. And I thought, well, that's really human. That's good of him. He really acknowledged to have some way of talking about the depth of our suffering at this difficult time. But then halfway through, he said it again. Death shouldn't exist. I thought it was a little bit odd to say it a second time. And then he said it a third time. And then he explained what he meant. He said, death shouldn't exist, but it exists because of Adam and Eve. They sinned. And therefore we carry our sin their sin with us, and that's why we have death now. Because of this kind of original sin that we carry with us. And the only thing we should do is to put our hands in the hands of Jesus and walk straight ahead and don't look back. Now, I don't know much about Christianity. I wasn't raised a Christian. I wasn't raised any religious way. But I was there. I came kind of really ready to kind of, you know, work with what I heard. But I had a hard time working with that. Because what I heard was an attempt by the minister to say, ignore what you're feeling, ignore the pain of the situation, and just kind of march ahead and leave it behind. Kind of put a smiling face on your face and just march ahead. And I was aware there was all the suffering in the room, all this pain, and that from the Buddhist point of view, we don't want to avoid that kind of pain and kind of put on kind of look ahead or ignore it. We want to be really honest about it, and starting with an honest acknowledgement of the pain, find our way forward. So I went up there and I just started acknowledging the pain that was there, and how difficult it was, and tried to put a very immediate human face on what people there were feeling. And I don't know, I think for the Buddhist half of the group, that was quite helpful. I don't know how it was for the others. But some people find it very helpful to discover a religious tradition that really wants to say, yeah, there is suffering in the world, and we're not going to deny it. We're not going to avoid it. We're not going to pretty it over. We're going to see it for what it is. And an important part of mindfulness practice is to learn how to relate to our suffering. Because, you know, to relate to it in an uncomplicated way, to relate to it in an unadorned way, to relate to it without resistance, without fear, to learn how to relate to it with some kind of equanimity, some kind of balance, just to see their suffering for what it is without making stories, interpretations, and assigning blame in all directions, or defending ourselves. Just kind of, oh, I'm really, this thing's really hard for me right now. I'm really tense, I'm really suffering, I'm depressed, and I'm unhappy. Whatever it is, just to really acknowledge it, see it for what it is. It can be such a great relief to acknowledge and see our suffering for what it is, as opposed to try to have a whole dance to kind of sidestep it or do something else with it or get rid of it in some unhealthy way. So some people think, oh, gee, this Buddhist religion, the first noble truth of Buddhism is there's suffering. What a downer religion. You know, I'm sure I could think of a better place to start for religious tradition. But it's kind of like, maybe Buddhism is not a religion, so that's maybe the whole topic in itself. But it's kind of like if you go to a doctor and you have some kind of illness, you know, you go in and you expect the doctor to kind of address you, your concerns around your particular illness. And the doctor says, you know, maybe you have an ingrown toenail. And it really hurts and you're suffering a lot because of it. And you go in and the doctor says, well, how's your throat today? You know, or what's the weather like where you live? Or, you know, the doctor doesn't want to talk at all about what's going on with your, you know. You expect when you go see a doctor, they're going to talk to you about your illness, right? The first thing you want to tell them is, I'm suffering, I'm sick, and this is what's going on with me. Where do you hurt, they say. And you don't want the doctor to kind of, you know, avoid it and kind of, oh, you know, it's not really a problem. You're not really having, you know. If you think positively, the illness will go away. And you want the guy or the gal to really kind of face it directly. So it's that kind of spirit that the Buddha wanted to put suffering as the first noble truth, was that if you really learn to address it and see it, then there's a possibility of seeing the cure for it or the solution to it, how to be free of it. And in fact, the medical analogy is not a poor one, because when the Buddha formulated the Four Noble Truths, he was actually borrowing from the ancient Indian medical model of how an ancient Indian doctor looked at illness. He would first identify the illness, he would identify the cause of the illness, would identify the possibility of a cure, and then would figure out the prescription, what the person had to do to become cured. So those four steps then the Buddha applied to our existential condition, our suffering, the source of the suffering, the possibility of ending it, and the eight-step prescription for it. So we start with a very honest assessment of our suffering. The second noble truth that we should understand is the cause of our suffering. And the Buddha defined that as thirst. And thirst is, he did not say it was desire. Sometimes in English people translate the second noble truth as desire, which problematizes all desire, which is not what the Buddha wanted to do. But a certain kind of desire that had a certain kind of neurotic craving, or kind of craving or clinging to it, kind of thirsting for something, full of neediness and demand or expectation, or some kind of contraction of the heart and the mind in the desire itself. That itself is the cause of suffering. Now, some people might protest and say, well, this doesn't make any sense. If I break my foot, I suffer. It's a lot of pain. That's not going to be caused by my clinging, my cravings, my aversions. The first noble truth is what the Buddha, the suffering he was talking about there, is understood by the second. And this is where some Buddhists would like to say that suffering is optional. And you ask, well, how is it optional? It seems like it's not optional. But what Buddhism is trying to address is that suffering which arises out of the way in which we choose to relate to the world or to ourselves. We choose to relate in a certain way where we get anxious. So the example I've been liking to give recently is, if you're stuck in rush hour traffic at 5 o'clock, bumper-to-bumper traffic, you're late for a very important appointment. The cars on the freeway are not causing you to suffer. The wait is not causing you to suffer. The delay, your appointment is not causing you to suffer. Where is the suffering born? So you might start by asking you first, where does the suffering reside? Does it reside in the car? Does it reside in all the cars in front of you? Does it reside in your calendar, your date book that says you're supposed to be someplace at 5 o'clock? Where does suffering reside? The suffering resides inside of you. The degree to which you have become tense or anxious or fearful or whatever it might happen, you get kind of contracted and tight and agitated because of the situation. That's the suffering. What's the cause of that suffering? It's very easy for us to say, oh, the cause is that I'm late. The cause is that jerk up there who won't move his car. It's very easy for us. It's almost like natural. It's like we almost expect it in English to say the cause of our suffering is something like that. Buddhism wants to take a very fine look at the cause of our suffering, almost try to take a really close look at the cause of suffering. And what it sees is that it isn't that the car in front of you or the guy in front of you who's not moving his car or that's causing the suffering, but the way we choose to relate to the awkward situation. It's possible to be in rush hour traffic and be late for something and be completely at peace. Or it's possible to be stuck in traffic and be fuming and upset. If we attribute our suffering to the conditions around us, you'll never be peaceful. You have to understand the causal steps that lead to your feeling suffering. You notice that you're late. You notice you're not making any progress on the freeway. That then is passed through an interpretation. Oh, this means that I'll be late. And this means that people are going to be upset with me. I feel really, it's very difficult for me to have people see me being upset. It ties into all my senses of lack of self-worth or inadequacy or whatever. And so I really don't want to have that discomfort of people being upset with me. And so we start contracting a little bit because of our distaste of having people upset with us. We choose to contract. It's not an automatic thing. And so we continue reacting to situations. So I don't know if that was a good example or not. I don't know if this is a good example either, but if, you know, another kind of simple example is that I'd like to give is, if all of us left today, this evening, with different shoes than we came with, different cars than we came with, our shoes wouldn't care. If someone else walked off with your shoe today, and you went out and didn't have any shoes out there to go home with, your shoe doesn't care. Your socks don't care. How do you interpret that? What happens inside of you? You might feel some distress and sadness, but do you then start getting angry Oh, how could that person have been so mindless in a mindfulness class to walk off in my shoes? And that movement of anger is optional. The task of mindfulness practice is to bring a very careful study at what causes us to suffer, and not to attribute it, our suffering, to things outside of us. And this is a huge challenge for many of us. And this is the challenge, the difficult challenge, the challenge that's awkward that Buddhism offers us. Buddhism says, your suffering is not caused by the world around you. Your suffering is caused by you yourself. That is a radical thing to say for many people, a very difficult thing to say, because it's very hard to see how we contribute to our own suffering, how we create it. I had the experience once, some years ago, of someone getting angry with me. And I had done something, like I'd showed up late for an appointment. And the person was furious with me and started yelling at me in anger. It was a pretty disrespectful way, but you know, anyway, she was yelling at me. And they continued for a while, and after a while I thought, this is really interesting. I wonder how long this person can talk and yell at me without me saying anything. And I was sitting like this, you know, so my meditation posture, I stayed very attentive and present for her. And it was like, just, you know, like I heard what she was saying, I was understanding everything, I was present for her. But I wasn't reacting to it. I wasn't taking it personally. I wasn't feeling hurt by it. I wasn't feeling attacked. I wasn't feeling, you know, I wasn't doing anything with it. It's just like this breeze going by. Anyway, it lasted for an hour. I was like, wow, this is amazing. How long is this going to last? You know, this is amazing. That was what was going through my mind inside. This is amazing. And then finally there was a bell, you know, in monasteries there are bells. So we had to go to, you know, the next event, so I excused myself then and went. And she said the next day how helpful it had been, because people always run away from her when she's angry. And she had never had the experience of someone who hung in there with her. And she actually found that it was actually helpful for her, learning herself to learn to relate to her own anger, to meet someone who hadn't been afraid of it or run away from it or gotten angry in return. So apparently it had some usefulness for her. But the point being that even someone being so furious in anger, angry towards me, didn't require me to suffer because of it. So, but we do often suffer in those situations. So if Buddhism is right and says that a cause of our suffering is inside of us and not outside, what actually is happening inside of you that's causing the suffering? There's a difference between what conditions our suffering and what causes it. The person yelling at me is a condition that allows the suffering to arise, but it's not the cause of it. Because I can suffer a lot if someone yells at me, or I can be at peace. The yelling itself is not the necessary cause for me to suffer. Being in rush hour traffic is not the necessary cause for suffering. It's a condition that allows it to arise. But it doesn't have to happen that way. So, what is it that we're thirsting? What are we clinging to? Another word I like for the cause of suffering is our drivenness. It's a very good word for the modern world, I think. So many of us are driven. And our drivenness causes suffering. When we have a desire or have an aversion, which we can't let go of, we can't drop easily, but it operates almost in a compulsive way, we'll suffer. And we have to learn to see what that is very carefully. And that's why mindfulness is such an important practice, such a powerful practice. Mindfulness is not only meant to as a form of stress reduction, as a form of kind of being more calmer and more at ease in life, but we use the ability to get more calm in order so we can look much more precisely at what goes on inside of us when we encounter the world. And that's not easy to do. But as we get better and better at it, we become, I think what most of you will find is you'll verify for yourself how much of your suffering is caused by yourself. And you'll stop blaming other people for why you suffer. You might blame them for creating the conditions for it, hold them responsible for creating the conditions for it, but you won't blame them for the causing it. You'll see how you cause it yourself. Am I making some sense to you? Objections?
Yeah.
Let's hear some objections. This is supposed to be very challenging. Yes?
Well, I think about, I understand what you're saying when people are angry and getting stuck in traffic, but what crossed my mind was your child dying, mm-hmm. your child sick, or seeing the pain in people that you love.
So there's this is a very important issue, and this is where Buddhism wants to distinguish. Maybe you want to accept this distinction, this is where the Buddha is trying to frame our experience in such a way we understand it, how to relate to it in a useful way, so we can be at peace with our situation. And so he was defining suffering here. The suffering that you can become free of is a suffering that you add by the way you relate to it. There might be sufferings in life that might not be the result. Be careful what I say here. In Buddhism, we distinguish between pain and suffering. And pain is an inevitable part of life. If you break your leg, you suffer. There's physical pain, physical suffering. The Buddha had a bad back. It was painful for him. If there's a loss, someone dies, I think there's a natural kind of pain of that loss. What happens to many of us is that we, on top of that, we add our reactivity to it. For example, people feel angry with themselves for, I didn't do enough to help. Or they feel shame for still feeling the grief. Or they feel embarrassed, or they feel, we have all these secondary and tertiary reactions on top of that primary feeling of pain. The idea with grief is to have uncomplicated grief. Have that natural grief that comes, have it move through you, but not to add what the Buddhism calls suffering on top of it. So if you allow or can see the distinctions being made between what we call the inevitable suffering of life and the optional, between what Buddhists might call the pain of life and this what Buddhism calls suffering, which is this stuff that is born out of our drivenness and reactivity. So empathy is a very important quality in Buddhist practice. And empathy is closely related to compassion, and it involves feeling the pain of others, or feeling pain in the suffering of others. You're not supposed to go, feel someone else's great suffering and just kind of go whistling down the street and say, whatever. Someone who's really sensitive to life will actually feel some pain in the context of someone else's suffering. But that pain is qualitatively and quantitatively different than suffering. Because it's possible to be at peace in the midst of receiving that kind of pain. It's possible to be at peace with oneself, with the world around us, while we're feeling a deep loss. We're not anxious, we're not in conflict. So maybe one way of maybe calling the First Noble Truth is that there is conflict in the world. And the conflict is born by our way we choose to respond to the world. And most of our suffering is born out of conflict, reacting, drivenness, wanting, desire, aversion, resistance. And it's that kind of suffering that Buddhism is a cure for. It's not a cure for the inevitable pains of life. It actually, we feel them more deeply. We're more open channels for them. But they also have less places to stick. And that's a beautiful thing. So the pains of life stick to us. And with practice, we learn not to stick with anything. So if we encounter someone else's suffering a lot, we're going to really be there and really feel that suffering very intimately and completely when we're with them. But if we leave and go off in some place, and we meet someone else who has one of the wonderful, most wonderful experiences of their life, we're then ready there to meet them fully. Is this making some sense?
I still think of other circumstances, you know, waiting to hear a doctor tell you what's going to happen, you know, after you've gone, you have the possibility of having something that you have, you're suffering, and I think it's just very challenging to make that separation.
Oh, it's phenomenally challenging.
To have the pain of the weight and at the same time not put all the other stuff on top of it.
It's phenomenally challenging, and we need to be very respectful of how difficult it is. But that's why the Four Noble Truths that the Buddha taught were not meant to be kind of just... They're meant to be radically challenging to us. And the Buddha is an example of someone who took it to the ultimate degree of understanding what this is all about. So he used his mindfulness to really investigate to the root in his own life what he added on to the situation. He was waiting in a doctor's office because he had this, you know, an ache or pain or something. He was not suffering. He wasn't anxious for it. He wasn't, you know, afraid of what was going to happen. He was, I'm sure he was concerned, but there wasn't all this anxiety on top of it because he really understood to the depth of, you know, he really resolved to the depth of his being these kinds of issues.
What was he resolved with?
Sorry?
What was he resolved with?
Oh, I don't know if he was resolved with anything, but he was resolved... He no longer had any. He had enough trust in life that he no longer needed to encounter life with a craving, with aversion, with fear, with confusion and doubt. To meet life fearlessly, the present moment, to meet it without craving, without desire, to meet it without aversion and resistance, is what it takes to be at peace. And so, all those that list of things I just went through. Are versions of the second noble truth, the cause of the suffering. And what the Buddha was teaching is it's possible to be very attentive, be very still, very quiet, very calm, and really get in, not only see it, but then uproot these very, very tenacious forces within us. So that it's possible for us to live at peace and be and have a much more comprehensive experience of happiness. And so the Four Noble Truths are a very direct approach to this. Look at your suffering really honestly. If you take your human situation and frame it another way, then it might be a roundabout way that might not be able to get to the source of what's going on. The first noble truth is suffering. The second is the cause. The third is it's possible to end suffering. And this is really the great news of Buddhism, is that it's really possible to experience the peace or the happiness that comes when we no longer are driven in any kind of way. There's no more compulsion, no more resistance, no more and fear isn't operating as an anxious source of reactivity within us. The Buddha recognized that those first three steps are very, very difficult to do. You know, to do them thoroughly. They can be very easy to do in some circumstances. Maybe in rush hour traffic it's really easy. I hope. And it can be very helpful. So these Four Noble Truths, using this framework, can be very helpful in some situations. It just clears things up really quickly. Oh. You know, I'm suffering because... you know, I'm in a hurry. And do I need to be in a hurry? Do I need to be driven to get somewhere? No, I don't need to be in a hurry. I can let go of my hurriedness. And then you can find yourself standing in Safeway line, shopping, you know, quite content and happy, looking at the National Enquirer, you know. So sometimes the Four Noble Truths are really easy to understand. But to understand how they apply to the depth of our life, so we really begin taking responsibility for our suffering really in a thorough way. The Buddha then prescribed the 8 steps because it's not easy. So the Buddha said, you need to do a lot of work. preparing yourself for, creating the right conditions to help you have the calm and the concentration so you can see really deeply into your life. So this is really, you know, a brief overview of these eight. The first is right understanding. And right understanding, from the Buddhist point of view, was understanding things from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths. Not that it's a true way exactly, it's a useful tool to understand it this way. The second step is right intention. To have a very honest assessment of what motivates you in your life, and to clarify and purify your motivations, to work on your motivations. Your motivations for your life are really closely connected to your suffering and your happiness. So you need to look at your intentions and motivations. The third is, the next three have to do with how you live your life. Buddha suggested that the way you make a livelihood is closely connected to your ability to do this work really deeply. And if you do a livelihood which causes harm to others, you're not going to be able to develop the kind of sensitivity that allows you to go really to the root of what causes your suffering. So he said, take an honest look at how you make a livelihood. If you involve with livelihoods that involve lying, that involve harming other beings, other people, if you're involved with making weapons or selling weapons or selling drugs or alcohol, that's probably not a very good livelihood. It's probably not the kind of livelihood that's going to allow you to develop the deeper sensitivity that's needed. So to look at your livelihood. The fourth is look at your speech. Cultivate and develop your speech. Have right speech. Speech is a phenomenal, powerful agent, condition for our suffering in the world. As you know, as it said, it can take 20 years to develop a friend, a good friend, and 2 minutes to lose her. You can say something in 2 minutes that can end 20 years of friendship. A speech is tremendously powerful. And if you begin taking care of your speech, learning good communication skills, learning how to speak in ways that are respectful for yourself and others, you're going to help make, kind of clarify your life and clarify your situation, that it becomes a lot easier to develop that deeper sensitivity and insight that's necessary. As someone said, it's better to tell the truth because there's less to remember. So if your speech involves a lot of lying, your life will get cluttered, your mind will get cluttered with all the things you have to remember to kind of keep the lies going. The sixth has to do with just basically morality, living an ethical life, not stealing and harming others. And then the last three of these eight steps have to do with more with meditation practice. Has to do with right effort, engaging yourself in a serious way, not being hesitant or resistant or lazy or not trying too much, but having a healthy engagement in trying to pursue a spiritual life. The seventh is to cultivate states of calm and concentration, to develop some ability to get concentrated, to let the mind become still, so that all the fragmented forces of the mind, the divisiveness within our mind, the agitation of the mind, begins to quiet down a little bit. Because an agitated mind can't see very well. That's why you should never talk about great political and philosophical and religious issues with people who are agitated or angry. Because you won't really get their best understanding coming forth. So to develop calm and concentration. And then the last of the eight steps is the mindfulness practice itself. But to develop the ability to see very honestly and directly what's happening in the present moment as it's occurring. The present moment itself is the key to unraveling the Four Noble Truths. This tremendous challenge of Buddhism is that the cause of our suffering is happening right now in the present moment as you're suffering. The conditions for our suffering might exist back in our history of things that happened before. But the present moment is a place where you can find infinite peace, and the present moment is a place where the causes of clinging, of resistance, of fear are occurring. And if you're lost in the past and lost in the future, preoccupied with the past and preoccupied in the future, you're not going to be able to see clearly what is the cause in the present moment. What is it right here and now that's causing you to suffer here and now? So mindfulness is a training to help keep us in the present moment so we can see clearly what's happening. And as we train ourselves to be in the present moment, to see clearly what's happening, then the phenomenal possibility of peace will be accessible to you. The astounding, all-pervasive, limitless experience of peace that is ever present in the present moment will open to you if you learn to be in the present moment and stay in the present moment for it. So I gave this talk today because it's a couple of weeks after I finished the introductory course, and I wanted to give you the classic Buddhist framework for Buddhist practice. It's quite beautiful because it's one of the central pillars of Buddhism, and it doesn't require any metaphysical beliefs, any metaphysical speculations, and so I think that's quite beautiful. That the Buddha said that your fundamental, the most profound levels of peace, of liberation that's accessible to human being, can be found through this doorway of the Four Noble Truths that requires no metaphysical beliefs on your part. In fact, the Buddha suggested that the framework of looking at your life through metaphysical beliefs is actually going to stand in your way of reaching the highest possibilities of peace that a person can experience. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think it's quite remarkable that there's this major world religion. The tenet, the major pillar of it, lacks a metaphysical belief, supernatural belief in anything. So I hope that this talk is challenging for you. I hope that to some degree it's disturbing for you. If you weren't disturbed by this talk, I didn't do a good job. But I hope also that it gave you some sense of inspiration or hopefulness, or that there's something that it's possible, that your life is workable and possible, and you can develop the tools to live a peaceful life and overcome your optional suffering that gets in our way. If this evening's talk seemed excessively complicated, then you can leave it here as you leave tonight. If you suffered because of this talk tonight, I'm not going to take any responsibility. You're going to have to look inside of yourself. It might have been a bad talk. That could well be, but if you suffered because of it, if you felt impatient or judgmental or resistant, that's your responsibility. You don't have to do those things. And how often do we take the time to look back at ourselves, at what we're doing in a situation, instead of looking out to judge or to blame the world around us for how we're feeling right now? So with that said, let's sit quietly and take some personal responsibility. It's a little short sitting. And you can always take a few deep breaths and best you can, empty your mind of thoughts and concepts. And spend these next minutes befriending your breath, being a welcome host for your breathing. In Buddhist circles, it's sometimes customary at the end of a meditation session or end of a practice period to, usually silently in one's own heart, to express a wish that all beings be happy, to have a wish that the practices and difficulties that each of us encounter in our spiritual life be of help not just to ourselves, but to all beings everywhere, so that our practice supports our wish for the well-being and happiness of all beings. May all beings be happy. May all beings be filled with delight. May all beings be at ease. May all beings be at peace. May all beings everywhere be happy. Thank you all, and I wish you a wonderful week.